Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. We speak slowly, using a simple style and limited vocabulary. Today on the show, Ann Ball brings us Ask a Teacher. I tell about a new movie, and we close the show with an American story. We hear the second part of The Murders on the Rue Morgue by Edgar Allan Poe. But first, here's Ashley Thompson.
An English town is asking British officials to approve legal personhood for the river that runs through it. Frome is a market town in the county of Somerset. It has asked Britain's government to effectively give the River Frome human rights. In doing so, Frome has joined a worldwide rights of nature movement. In each case, communities are reimagining ways to use the law to defend the Earth's living tissues and the places they call home. Peter McFadden is the mayor of Frome. He and his supporters see their efforts as part of a struggle to reset the balance between nature and the modern world. This is much bigger than just wanting to punish people for doing something wrong, McFadden said. It's about trying to change a mindset about the environment in which we live. The town has been waiting for months for an answer from the government. Supporters of nature's rights see Frome as the first test case for the movement in Europe. But some in Frome are not so sure. Lawyer Neil Howlett lives by the river. Howlett says he supports many of the community building steps taken by McFadden and other independent local politicians. But he sees the council's push for a river's rights bylaw as a distraction. Having a law which is completely outside the cultural basis of the society in which you pass the law doesn't make for a law that works, Howlett said. It's lovely as an idea, but it's only lovely as an idea. Some indigenous peoples have long believed that rivers, mountains, and lakes are in some sense living beings. In 1972, American Christopher Stone expressed the idea in modern-day legal terms. Stone wrote a book called Should Trees Have Standing? In it, he argued that the best way to protect things in nature would be to give them the kinds of legal protections usually only offered to human beings. That idea is spreading. Campaigners won what is called the first Rights of Nature courtroom victory in Ecuador in 2011. In that case, judges stopped a road widening project from leaving stones in the Vilcabamba River. Around the same time, Bolivia developed a vision of nature's rights in a law known as the Law of the Right of Mother Earth. In 2017, New Zealand's parliament became the first legislature to confirm a river's legal personhood. That same year, a high court in India ruled that the Ganga and Yamuna rivers had legal rights. Colombia's constitutional court made a similar move for the Atrato River Basin, where communities face illegal gold mining and paramilitary violence. This summer, Bangladesh recognized the rights of all its rivers. Supporters see such rulings as an important part in moving away from the goal of economic growth while ignoring ecological harm. The current system is programmed for self-destruction, and the legal system is the enabler, said lawyer Mumta Ito. She founded Nature Rights, a Scotland-based advocacy group that has been advising Frome's town council. Ito added, "The only way we'll be able to change things is by creating a new operating system with nature's rights at its core." The world's waterways face growing pressure from the extremes of heat, rainfall, and dry weather, all driven by climate change. McFadden argues that any effort that helps people to look at nature differently is important. "We're in the situation we are in because we've misunderstood our position in the ecosystem," he said. "We can't do what we like. If we pour poison over everything, it comes back to bite us." I'm Ashley Thompson.
With the right marketing, you can get people to buy almost anything. This is especially true in Manhattan, where many wealthy New Yorkers live. In the new film, The Sound of Silence, lead characters Peter and Ellen meet because she has paid him to tune her apartment. No, Ellen does not live inside a musical instrument. Peter, played by actor Peter Sarsgaard, is a home tuner. His especially strong sense of hearing enables him to hear small things that most others cannot. They might include an ice maker, toaster, or other simple machinery. Rashida Jones plays Ellen. She is tense and sleepless. Some friends suggest she turn to Peter for help. The skill he brings to his work had been reported about in The New Yorker, a respected magazine. Peter travels around New York City with his tuning devices and his headset. He tests wind movements in parks and makes house calls. At Ellen's place, he lies on her bed to try to recreate her usual mornings. Then he explains the problem, her toaster. He advises her to get a new one. The Sound of Silence is based on a short film from the same writer and director, Michael Tyberski. Peter makes the lives of his customers better. He helps them sleep or improves their love relationships. He is more centered on helping others than seeking riches. But he longs for recognition in the academic world. He wants his scientific findings to gain wide acceptance. So when a sharp businessman offers him the chance to join forces and make some real money, he is not interested. He does not want to sink that low. At the same time, Ellen is showing more interest in Peter, finding his intensity appealing. For a while, we do too. Especially when he explains that Bach and Beethoven, no less, used neurological methods to affect their listeners. But even Ellen questions Peter's expertise. She finds it hard to accept his claims that her home is producing the musical note of C minor. He also tells her that unseen forces are governing her choices. However, he stops trusting in his expertise as his effort to help her fails. And Ellen chooses to keep believing that she has some control over her life. The sound of silence is humor and seriousness combined. There is a painful scene in which Peter meets an academic he greatly respects. She is a leading specialist in the field of sound. When he asks her if she has seen the work he sent her, her answer is unkind but honest. Critics have been mixed on the success of The Sound of Silence. The Los Angeles Times calls the movie fascinating, original, and yes, deeply resonant. The Hollywood trade magazine Variety, however, says the film feels undernourished in its new long version form. It calls The Sound of Silence a deeply silly movie that takes itself incredibly seriously. The movie has been presented at several film festivals since the start of the year. It opened to the general public in limited release on Friday.
This week, we answer a question from Chu Yun. Our reader, Chu Yun, writes, "May I know what is the difference between a film and a movie? You have a program named English at a Movie. Why not English at a Film?" Dear Chu Yun, thank you for writing in with two good questions. Film and movie mean the same thing. The word you use may help others guess where a person lives or is from. First, let's look at the word film. One definition is the special material used for taking photographs. But you can also see a film in a theater. Used this way, film and movie mean the same thing. And as a verb, to film means to record something with a video camera. Here is an example. Do you want me to film the ceremony so you can remember it? Now, let's turn to movie. The word, a noun, comes from the phrase moving pictures. Movies and films are recordings of moving images that tell a story. Here are some example sentences with the word movie. Do you want to go to the movies tonight? If you go to Hollywood in California, you might see a movie star. In the United States, it is common to say the movies for when you talk about going to a movie theater. Here is an example for you. Do you know what's playing at the movies this weekend? Stephen Follows is a writer, producer, and film data researcher who lives in England. He wrote that people who work in the film industry use film more than movies. People who live in the U.S., he found, usually say movie, while those in Britain use both. Film is still popular in Europe and parts of Africa, but movie is best in the Americas, as well as in Japan and India. So that is why we say English at the movies and not English at the films. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Ann Ball.
For 3 days a week, Wayne Garcia has been taking part in a non-traditional exercise. He starts by putting on virtual reality equipment on his head. He then gets on a specially designed exercise bicycle and starts pushing its pedals. Faster and faster he goes. Garcia is taking part in a study at the University of Southern California's Keck School of Medicine. Researchers want to see if just a small amount of VR can help prevent memory loss as people age. Garcia says he remembers how his parents and grandparents all suffered from dementia.
It's very scary that one day that could be me.
Garcia recalls his father once reading a newspaper upside down and almost setting the house on fire by putting a towel on a heater.
Just the sadness, because you remember what your dad was like, what your mom was like when they were good, and then the decline now, and now you're taking care of them rather than when they used to take care of you.
Garcia is taking part in the study to see if using virtual reality at the same time as physical exercise can help prevent dementia in the future. Judy Pa is part of the team of researchers leading the study. She says the actual definition of dementia is when a person is no longer able to take care of themselves, things like paying the bills, driving, cooking for themselves, dressing themselves. She added that the breakdown and death of cells in the nervous system take 10 to 20 years. Pa said that unlike usual games, VR provides a first-person, three-dimensional experience that is important to memory training.
Our goal is to prevent dementia, to prevent Alzheimer's disease. There are no effective treatments yet. We hope that we will get there eventually. But my perspective and the research that we do in my laboratory at USC is really surrounding prevention.
The VR study exercises the subject's body and brain at the same time, testing the memory and decision-making part of their brain. Subjects have to pedal on the exercise bike and keep their heart rate up. In the VR experience, they are trying to learn and remember directions while collecting food items and then feeding the food to some animals.
Understanding changes in the brain that happen with exercise, changes in the brain that happen when you're in an enriched environment, and putting those two together, and that's what our intervention is currently targeting.
Even if virtual reality can help, it may not be for everyone. In one study, 4 out of 40 people withdrew from the research because they reported motion sickness. Pa will be doing more tests over the next year with participants who are 50 to 80 years old to gather additional information. Garcia is hopeful for what VR might mean for the future.
There might be a place where you could go and you can get your daily dose of virtual reality and cardio to keep the mind going.
I'm Jonathan Evans. The Murders in the Rue Morgue by Edgar Allan Poe. Part 2.
It was in Paris in the summer of 1840 that I met Auguste Dupin. Dupin was a strangely interesting young man with a busy, forceful mind. He seemed to look right through a person and uncover their deepest thoughts. Sometimes Dupin seemed to be not one, but two people. One who coldly put things together, and another who just as coldly took them apart. One morning, in the heat of the summer, Dupin showed me once again his special mental power. We read in the newspaper about a terrible killing. An old woman and her daughter, living alone in an old house in the Rue Morgue, had been killed in the middle of the night. The story in the paper went,
Paris, July 7th, 1840. Early this morning, cries of terror were heard in the western part of the city. They reportedly came from a house on the Rue Morgue, in which the only occupants were a Mrs. L'Espanier and her daughter Camille. Several neighbors and a policeman ran to the house. By the time they reached it, the cries had stopped. They forced the door open. As they entered, they heard two voices, apparently from above. The group searched but found nothing until the fourth floor. There they came to a door locked from the inside. Quickly, they forced it open. Before them was a bloody horror scene. The room was in total disorder, broken chairs and tables, and the mattress pulled from the bed. Blood was everywhere. On the walls, the floor, the bed. A sharp knife lay on the floor in a pool of blood. In front of the fireplace was a clump of long gray hair, also bloodied. It seemed to have been pulled straight out of a head. On the floor were four pieces of gold, an earring, several silver objects, and two bags containing a large amount of money in gold. Clothes had been thrown around the room. A lockbox was found left open with just a few old letters and papers inside. There was no one there, but when the group inspected the fireplace, they discovered another horror. A still warm body had been forced up the chimney. It was the old woman's daughter. There was blood on the face and dark, deep finger marks on the neck, suggesting a strangling. After searching the house thoroughly, the group went outside. They found the body of the old woman behind the building. Her neck had been cut so severely that when they tried to lift the body, the head fell off.
The next day, the newspaper offered to its readers these new facts.
Paris, July 8, 1840. The police have questioned many people about the vicious murders in the old house on the Rue Morgue, but none of the answers revealed the identity of the killers. Pauline Dubourg, a washwoman, said she has known both of the victims for more than 3 years and washed their clothes. She said, "The two seemed to love each other dearly. They always paid her well. She did not know where their money came from," she said. "She never met anyone in the house. Only the two women lived on the fourth floor." Pierre Moreau, a shopkeeper, said Mrs. L'Espanier had bought food at his shop for almost 4 years. She owned the house and had lived in it for more than 6 years. He never saw anyone enter the door except the old lady and her daughter, and a doctor 8 or 10 times, perhaps. Many other persons, neighbors, said the same thing. Almost no one ever went into the house. Mrs. L'Espanier and her daughter were not often seen. Banker Jules Mignot said that Mrs. L'Espanier had put money in his bank, beginning 8 years before. 3 days before the killings, she withdrew a large amount in gold. A man from the bank carried it to her house for her. Isidore Musée, a policeman, said that he was with the group that first entered the house. While he was going up the stairs, he heard two voices, one low and soft, and one hard, high, and very strange. The voice of someone who was surely not French, the voice of a foreigner, maybe Spanish. It was not a woman's voice, he said, although he could not understand what it said. But the other voice said softly, in French, "My God." Alfonso Garcia, who is Spanish and lives on the Rue Morgue, says he entered the house but did not go up the stairs. A nervous man, he was afraid he might be sick. He heard the voices. He believes the high voice was not that of a Frenchman. Perhaps it was English, but he said he doesn't understand English, so he is not sure. William Byrd, an Englishman who has lived in Paris for 2 years, also entered the house. He said the low voice was that of a Frenchman, he was sure, because he heard it say, in French, "My God." The high voice was very loud, he said. He is sure it was not the voice of an Englishman, nor the voice of a Frenchman. It seemed to be that of an Italian, a language he does not understand. He said it might have been a woman's voice. Mr. Alberto Montani, an Italian, was passing the house at the time of the cries. He said the screams lasted for about 2 minutes. Montani, who speaks Spanish but not French, says that he also heard two voices. He thought both voices were French, but he could not understand any of the words spoken. All who went in the house agreed that the door to the room on the fourth floor was locked from the inside. It was quiet. They saw no one. The windows were closed and locked from the inside. There is only one stairway to the fourth floor. They said that the chimney opening is too small for escape that way. It took 4 or 5 people to pull the daughter's body out of the chimney. It was 4 or 5 minutes from the time they heard the voices to the moment they entered the room. Paul Dumas, a doctor, says that he was called to inspect the bodies soon after they were found. They were in a horrible condition, badly marked and broken. He said only a man could have caused such injury. The daughter had been strangled, he said.
When we had finished reading the newspaper's report of the murders, we were quiet for a while. Dupin had that cold, empty look that I know means his mind is working busily. He asked me what I thought of the crime. I said I considered it a mystery with no answer. But Dupin responded,
"No, no. No, I think you are wrong. A mystery, yes, but there must be an answer. Let us go to the house and see what we can see. There must be an answer. There must."
That's our show for today. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, with more stories from around the world. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.